Recorded on location at Aspen Ideas Health in Aspen, Colorado.
We are on location at Aspen Ideas Health, and we are joined by Gregory Jackson, who's the Deputy Director of the Office of Gun Violence Prevention at the White House and also Special Assistant to President Biden.
I grew up in rural Virginia. My dad had 26 guns. Mm-hmm. I inherited a gun. I'm a gun owner. And so the Office of Gun Violence Prevention is led by gun owners. Right. And so we like to just start with that. Secondly, recognizing that we're not here to infringe on rights and have those discussions. Yep. We're really just trying to save lives from what has become the largest health crisis of our time.
And in this important role, Gregory Jackson oversees efforts to implement federal law, to identify new executive actions, to expand partnerships, and to improve services for those traumatized by violence.
We were walking home from a party, and there was a fight that broke out, and a shootout happened, and the bullet that hit me hit two arteries and nearly cost me my life. And I'll never forget, I was shot just 3 days after the failed universal background checks vote in the Senate. And so it was just so heartbreaking and infuriating, frankly, to see political leaders I look up to, you know, make excuses of why they couldn't take action or why they couldn't get it done. And that was kind of a turning point for me. I just kind of promised that if I could ever get out of the bed again, I would do all I can to fight for change.
And this is Conversations on Healthcare.
Well, Greg, well, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare. So great to have you. And you know, you had such a great session the other day about gun violence. Maybe you could share with our audience what you've been thinking about, what you were talking about the other day with some of your colleagues. Yeah. I think everyone would be quite interested.
Yeah, I mean, well, thanks you for having me. This is amazing.
Delighted.
Beautiful Aspen, this amazing show. But we started off really with the simple big idea that gun violence is a health crisis and not just a crime crisis. And when you look at the impacts of gun violence in our country, being the number one cause of death for youth, 1 in 5 Americans losing someone to gun violence, and it also being the leading cause of newly disabled Americans, the health impacts are undeniable. And so we talked a lot about that throughout Aspen, but what was also exciting is to know that some of the health-based strategies that have started to be funded federally through this administration are having a huge impact, like expanding the 988 crisis lifeline, investing in youth mental health programs and school-based mental health professionals, and investing in community-based strategies that practice kind of behavioral therapy for at-risk and most vulnerable individuals across the country. And so these types of programs and investments are starting to take hold, and we're starting to see some really great results.
So a real shift from law enforcement to public health. Yeah. And I think that's the conversation that I think the public would like to know more about. And you've laid out some of that, and we'll explore more of it. But I don't think people have that in their frame of reference when you're thinking about gun violence, the public health element of it.
Yeah, but thankfully the president did. He was the first president to acknowledge this as a public health crisis. And once you acknowledge it as a crisis, you have to demand an approach, just like automobiles and COVID-19 and opioids. And so that's what we've started to build out in this administration. And it's been exciting to watch health leaders lead the way, knowing that too often, you know, ERs and doctors and first responders, they see the carnage, but aren't always invited to be a part of the solutions.
Well, one death by gun is a tragedy. Yeah. The CDC in 2021, I think is the last formal official tally, 48,830 deaths by gun, including, of course, suicides, homicides, all a great tragedy. Accidental shooting, certainly among children, a great tragedy. And I think one of the things that your office is really focused on is collaboration. And I heard you say schools and a few other groups, but tell us more about this. What's the strategy you've laid out that says we've got to have all these partners at the table, and how are you giving them voice and presence in this national debate?
Yeah, well, just starting with the government, our first week on the job in September of 2023, we were asked to present some ideas because there was a cabinet meeting that week. And, you know, we thought, well, okay, what does that have to do with us? And they said, well, here are all the agencies that will be reflected please bring at least 3 to 5 ideas for each agency. And some of them, I didn't even know what they were. I was like,
what an opportunity.
And technology policy? Yeah. But we learned, and a lot of the agencies had already kind of come up with different ideas. For example, Department of Labor has a program called Growth Opportunities that focuses on at-risk individuals, like at-risk youth under 24, and provides job training. And so one of their proposals was, why don't we focus that on communities most impacted by gun violence and poverty? Uh-huh. The Department of Education knew that safe storage is a big way that they could reduce violence.
Absolutely.
And so one of the ideas that we came up with was coming together to roll out a national campaign educating parents on safe storage. Mm-hmm. And most recently in New York City, the mayor did a big press conference about the city
about
of New York, rolling out their safe storage campaign, answering the call of the Department of Education. And so we're starting to see every agency, like the Department of Veteran Affairs, giving out safe storage boxes and talking about lethal means and how that impacts suicide. So we started there. And so that was huge. We also started to get the agencies involved in the reactive work too. So we built a 10-agency FEMA-style response team that can help communities recover from these mass shootings or these high concentrations or surges in violence. And so everything from small business loans to maybe a grocery store, like unfortunately what happened in Arkansas.
Just yesterday.
Terrible.
To
a team in the Department of Education that can help schools reopen and help them think through what is their plan to kind of get back to some form of normalcy. So we started there. Then we pushed a little further and said, how do we go beyond the doors of government and find new partners? And thankfully, the gun violence movement is huge and robust, and there are so many organizations that we're able to bring in the door. But we also started to think about, how do we get the health space involved? And just 2 weeks ago, we did a convening with 80 health CEOs overseeing systems across the country to really talk to them about what ideas they have and how can they better partner with the government, but really start to lean in and lead on this issue. And so we're still building, you know, within government and outside of government, finding new partners that all are a part of this, you know, community-wide approach.
Well, that's incredible, because as we were, I think, saying just a few minutes before we started, we also lead a federally qualified health center, of which there's 1,400 across the country, taking care of 40 million people. And every one of those departments you mentioned touches the work of community health centers. So the force multiplier effect of your collaboration is really tremendous.
No, and I think about best practices. You know, states are engines of innovation. And then when, and the federal government has come late to this, except for the president's new initiative by opening this division. Talk about what you see out across the country. I know you've talked about Maryland and others, but what can people look to, whether it's New York City or the state of Maryland? Where else are you seeing bright ideas?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's so much happening right now. One of the coolest things is, you know, in 2008, there were only, I believe, 10 offices of violence prevention in the country at the city level. Now there's over 60.
Wow.
And so we brought them together to the White House about 3 weeks ago just to, one, celebrate that they exist and hear about the innovative strategies that they're implementing. You know, places like Green Bay, Wisconsin have very robust suicide prevention programs. Yeah. And Charlotte, North Carolina is almost completely focused on youth violence intervention. And we're seeing each city kind of create their own tailored approach to addressing the crisis of violence based on how it's showing up in their communities. We're also seeing states. This year alone, 6 new states are building their own statewide offices. And so we had North Carolina, which was the first in the South. Now we have one in Maryland, for example, and Governor Moore attributed the administration and invited us to be there for the big speech, and also invited us to help him build it. So, you know, no good deed.
Yeah, goes unpunished.
Exactly.
Unrewarded.
So we're excited to see, like, infrastructure being built that can start to pull state and local governments beyond just law enforcement to the table to be a part of these solutions. A couple cool things. We're also seeing new legislation passed around lost and stolen firearms. Yep. We know that's a huge problem in America, where over the last 5 years, over 1 million guns have been stolen. And the time between a stolen gun and a crime scene is very, very short. So the more we can do around preventing lost and stolen guns, or at least reporting it faster, makes a big difference. We've also seen a huge focus on victim services. And in places like Chicago, they're thinking about how can they get to victims and families sooner to help them deal with that trauma, to hopefully disrupt the cycle and prevent any retaliation. So between victim services, new offices, looking at lost and stolen guns, a safe storage work in New York City and in Las Vegas too, we're watching a lot of different innovative approaches starting to be implemented. Our team, we did roll out what's called the Safer States Agenda, where we had 15 policy proposals that we offered to states. And we actually convened legislators from 37 states to talk about these solutions and how they can pass laws. And of those 37 states, 31 of them have passed laws from our Safer States Agenda. Wonderful. So we're starting to see change happen everywhere from Texas to New York and even beautiful places like Colorado.
Well, it sounds in many ways like you're taking almost a population health approach, as we would call it, in healthcare. And I know we've read that there's widespread support for legislation that would prevent people with mental illness or mental health issues, quite a continuum there, from having access to or owning guns. What's the office's work in that area, and maybe what's the role that healthcare plays in that?
Yeah, I mean, the big thing for us is we're seeing a lot of cases where individuals are in crisis and they have easy access to a firearm. And so it's less about how they're diagnosed, but that moment of crisis and how do we create time and space between that firearm and that moment of crisis. And so the primary thing that we focused on is one, how do we prevent people from getting to crisis? And so investing more in mental health resources and services and more access to mental health resources and supports. But then, frankly, pushing for red flag laws. This administration rolled out $750 million to help states implement their extreme risk protection order laws, which can allow, you know, the courts to remove guns from the home in a time of crisis. Yeah. And we strongly believe that you can always return a gun, but you can't return a life. Right. And so these types of policies and programs are very impactful. And we're seeing even the reddest of states be enthusiastic about it. In Florida, they've used their red flag law over 12,000 times.
Yeah.
It was Republican-led and Republican-championed, and it's saving lives every day from suicide and mass tragedy and homicide.
Well, so good that you talk about red states, blue states, because gun violence happens in everywhere in America. Talk about the seam of opportunity of having conversations with people who may be gun owners, people who believe fundamentally it's a right to own a gun. What do those conversations look like? I know the president's reached out across the country, but I'm sure your office, as you indicated, but what are some of the struggles that you might encounter in trying to engage people?
Yeah, well, I think it's important to acknowledge that the president is a gun owner. I grew up in rural Virginia. My dad had 26 guns. I inherited a gun, I'm a gun owner. And so The Office of Gun Violence Prevention is led by gun owners.
Right.
And so we like to just start with that. Secondly, recognizing that we're not here to infringe on rights and have those discussions. Yeah. We're really just trying to save lives from what has become the largest health crisis of our time. And when we talk about responsible gun ownership, I think most of our enthusiastic gun owners, especially those in recreation and sports, and former military, they know what it takes to be a responsible gun owner and all the different risks and the steps you take. But unfortunately, that standard is not common knowledge for every gun owner in America. And we have a huge surge of new gun owners, over 400 million guns in America. And so we have to make sure that we're thinking about safe storage, making sure people are trained, the importance of permitting, the importance of background checks. All of these steps are just to make sure that guns are in the hands of those who are in crisis or mean to cause harm. And that's very different from the recreational person that's at the gun range, you know, every Saturday with their son.
Right.
And so I think if we can just connect those dots, it really helps to show that we're here to save lives first and to really strengthen the standard of responsible gun ownership. I think that's a great meeting place to start from. And frankly, we have a lot of activists and leaders that are gun owners that are a part of this movement. I think we just have to get past this polarizing debate around gun rights and more focused on how do we make our country safer from the violence that is obviously costing us lives.
Well, I want to go back for just a second to highlight those red flag laws. Yeah. And I think they could stand a little more public awareness. I think people can tolerate a short-term intervention versus saying this is for life. You know, this is an act, something you're barred from forever. So thank you for flagging that. But my guess is something like that often lands also in state health departments to carry out the public health education campaign. And our state public health offices are so stretched after COVID. And I'm not sure I heard them at the table when you were going through your partners. What's the relationship with state departments of health, CDC, about getting this out?
Well, it's definitely an area of growth. I mean, I think this is the first administration that's really leaned in on, you know, with Department of Health and Human Services and CDC and the Surgeon General on how to really bring these worlds together. This was the first CDC director in history to really come out boldly on this.
North Carolina person.
Yes, exactly. and so we're seeing these worlds really come together, but there's still a lot of coordination to do. You know, federally, there is now emergency resources after a mass shooting. We're seeing new programs being rolled out that focus on youth that have been impacted by violence. And really the National Traumatic Stress Network for youth is a huge tool and resource that we're starting to make sure it's connecting
really
with survivors of gun violence too. So these worlds are starting to bridge more at the national level. I think there's definitely more work to do at the state and local level, but it also reinforces why these state and city level offices are so important. In the state of Maryland, I'm pretty confident their office is housed in the Department of Health. So we're starting to see that trend of putting these offices on the health side, not just on the public safety side. So I think we're getting there.
Yeah, and Greg, you mentioned CDC, and it's really the first time in 20 years that the new legislation allowed the CDC to do research on gun violence. And so it unshackled the CDC in terms of that. What initiatives do you know they're undertaking?
Oh man, well, they're doing amazing work looking at the different types of approaches to reducing gun violence. I think some of the most exciting research has been around community violence intervention programs and the impacts and how they're working in different communities. A lot of research on red flag laws and how they're being implemented or not being implemented. I think what you what we'll all be excited to see soon is a bigger emphasis on injuries and what is the ripple and impact of injuries. I shared earlier, it's the leading cause of newly disabled Americans, but we don't talk enough about those who are impacted and survive and what trauma that creates and what cycles of violence that could create. So I know that's a direction they're heading, and we're excited to see more data and research in that space of, you know, how do we help those who have been impacted and not just, you know, focused on the prevention and intervention side.
So is your office, I'm sure not charged with maybe the research itself, but you're glad you're not charged with the research itself, I can tell that. But there is a lot of focus on root cause, right? And that's true in health, that's true in just about anything where you're trying to affect change down the road. You mentioned the traumatic stress networks. What are the other root causes that people are putting out there in terms of gun violence?
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest root cause or the biggest connector to a lot of these tragedies is trauma. We found that most shooters have been traumatized first in some way, shape, or form. In inner cities, is being exposed to another shooting. And whether it's domestic violence or violence in the home, we're seeing even with mass shooters, some other trauma was there. So really pouring into helping treat trauma of those who've been abused in different ways or harmed in different ways. We're also looking at economic opportunity. Again, the Department of Labor has been a big partner for us. They've rolled out six new funding programs focused on how do we get to those who are most impoverished and dealing with concentrations of violence. Department of Education is doing a great job getting to youth earlier. They have a program called Project Prevent that focuses on elementary age youth and, that have been traumatized by violence and how do we provide resources and support for them to navigate through that and still live a healthy, kind of balanced education life. So I think there's, we're thinking about trauma, economic opportunity, and really education and youth, and how do we get to folks earlier. It's probably the main areas we're working in. We also have seen a huge effort from Department of Veteran Affairs.
Absolutely, we had them on the show recently talking about this. Just heartbreaking hearing those statistics.
It is, but they're making historic strides too. You're talking about the role of guns and how that can be harmful and how that feeds into the cycle of suicide, which is tough, you know, to discuss with veterans, but also the urgency of safe storage. They're giving out safe storage devices to veterans, knowing that, hey, you might be a very responsible, well-trained owner of a gun, but you still have to store it when the kids come over, or you still may need to store it if you're in a moment of crisis. Yeah. So I think those are kind of some of the partners that we're looking at. But frankly, the root cause work, we're really starting to just dive into it because we've been so focused on the intervention that we can do right now.
Well, it's another great tie for healthcare and the focus on screening children for adverse childhood events, screening for traumatic events, having services in the schools to work with kids like the school-based health center. So it really, those collaborations we talked about a little while ago sound like they are really at the root of your success, which is tremendous, along with legislation.
And so exciting that you're covering school-based, you're thinking about veterans and thinking about innovations. None of this would have happened unless President Biden set up the first Office of Gun Violence Safety and Prevention. Talk a little bit about the department or the office itself. It's 2 years old. How's it look? How do people access it?
Well, we're only 9 months old.
9 months, okay. two years since the legislation.
Yeah, 2 years since the bill. Well, yeah, our office is, we're small but mighty. And we pride ourselves on partnership. You know, we're made up of Steph Feldman, our director. She's also the staff secretary. So Secretary of the United States of America is also leading this effort, which is huge. There are two deputies, Rob Wilcox and myself. Both of us are survivors of gun violence and have been in this fight for a long time. Rob's been in the space for 15 years. I've been in this space for 11. And then beyond that, we have Sarah Wiener, who's our policy coordinator, who's brilliant and can move through the White House building like a Ginsu, you know, organizing and getting things done for us. And so that's kind of the core of our office. I mean, a lot of what we do is implementation focused. And I'm really proud to say that of the Bipartisan Safer Communities Act, we have fully implemented it. And on June 25th, which is the 2 year anniversary, we're going to celebrate the full implementation of the law and what we think that can mean for the future of our country. But now that that big piece is done, we're pushing hard on new ideas, whether it be our new safe storage initiative. This past week, we rolled out a new partnership with AmeriCorps called Safer America Network. So there's over 500 sites that are doing some type of violence prevention work. And so we're helping to train and recruit more volunteers to be a part of these sites and basically create a pipeline for new professionals and leaders to be a part of solving the problems of gun violence and working with those who are most at risk or most vulnerable.
But you have the White House, right? I mean, that's the big difference
that
you're able to project across the country. You might be small, but you're able to say it with the authority speaking from out of the White House, which I think is very important.
Been amazing.
Tell us a little bit about your own experience with gun violence. And, you know, we're sorry you had to go through that. And,
You know, God works how he works in mysterious ways, but beautiful ways. For me, that's kind of how I started in this work. I was someone who was already in politics and already had been on more like the campaign side of the world. But in April of 2013, I had my cousins in town from North Carolina, and we were walking home from a party, and there was a fight that broke out and a shootout happened. And the bullet that hit me hit two arteries and nearly cost me my life. And I'll never forget, I was shot just 3 days after the failed universal background checks vote in the Senate. And so it was just so heartbreaking and infuriating, frankly, to see political leaders I look up to, you know, make excuses of why they couldn't take action or why they couldn't get it done. And that was kind of a turning point for me. I just kind of promised that if I could ever get out of the bed again, I would do all I can to fight for change and not just wait for some elected official to do it for me, but try to get in there and push it myself. But my recovery was much longer. It wasn't like the movies, you know, you get shot, you don't shake it off and keep moving. I spent 6 months in recovery, 21 days in the hospital, across 6 different surgeries. And I was bedridden most of that time. And so it was really, really tough, but it was also a moment to reflect and learn more about this issue and different solutions that exist.
Have you been able to share that story with others who are recovering? And it's a very powerful story. And, and I think it's so important to people to know that it's not the movies where the bullet goes in and people keep on marching forward.
I mean, that the trauma will live with you forever. But for a lot of us, the physical damage is there forever. And actually, even at Aspen, you know, one of the other speakers that talked about worm treatment during the Aspen Health Ideas, one of the big ideas. She's also a survivor of gun violence. She was shot when she was 12 in the chest, actually. And so we connected on that. And I think there are just so many survivors out there. We forget that while, you know, only around 40,000 folks are killed each year, over 100,000 are injured every year. So since I was shot in 2013, that means a million more survivors are now in our country. And that number keeps growing. And that's people who are just physically harmed, right? So it's I'm part of a interesting
fraternity.
A fraternity of folks.
Well, we're all part of this kind of world community. And we're based in Connecticut. So we of course, had the experience of living through Sandy Hook on that very dark, sunny December day years ago. But, you know, we recognize also the trauma of the those folks who cared for you and your colleague that you just described in the emergency room, that the first responders that are out there seeing this, the first responders on the scene of something like a Sandy Hook. And I understand you have some initiatives going on in your office about helping those folks as well.
Well, through the Office of Veterans Affairs, Department of Veteran Affairs, there are resources directly for first responders. In addition, we're trying to make sure that there are more resources for families after they're impacted or lose someone. So we're looking pretty closely at the Crime Victims Fund through the Office of Victims of Crime and DOJ, and figuring out how can we make sure those dollars are more accessible to families and individuals that have been impacted, and also make sure they're inclusive of first responders that are traumatized too, because many of them have to go through their own therapeutic support and care. And, unfortunately, I was in Lewiston, Maine after that tragedy a few months ago, and we saw that ripple firsthand of how first responders were going through, you know, so much anguish. But we were able to provide resources for therapeutic care through DOJ and through Veterans Affairs, and I think just making sure that we keep them in mind the same way we do with law enforcement.
And do the research. What's the most effective way to respond?
Greg, you're not only a survivor, but you also worked before as the executive director of the Community Justice Action Fund. Talk a little bit about that. How has it informed the work that you're doing today?
So Community Justice Action Fund, we were focused on how gun violence impacts Black and brown communities specifically. And we found that policy-wise, that had been overlooked. And our organization actually helped organize the first hearing on urban gun violence in American history, and that was in 2019. And we know how bad violence has been in inner cities and how it's disproportionately impacted Black and brown communities, but it hadn't been a federal policy or a federal priority until that time. And so our organization really just pushed for policy changes and resources to address that crisis. And some of the biggest wins was funding for community violence intervention programs. When we started, there was $0 for these types of strategies. So programs for at-risk youth, programs that do intervention work, whether it's in hospitals or communities to help de-escalate conflicts. These types of programs were proven to be very effective and have been around for decades, but had zero federal dollars. And so we started by pushing for that. And I'm proud to say community justice can be accredited for around $12 billion now.
All right.
Are federal dollars that are going into these inner city community-led strategies. Another big thing was gun trafficking. You know, we knew that guns are getting into inner cities and into communities that may already have tough gun laws and may not even have gun stores, right? But you have guns everywhere and they're coming in illegally through a black market. And so we pushed hard for that. And this Biden-Harris administration was the first one to make gun trafficking a federal offense. So prior to this, you would just get a written warning, like you parked in a, you know, in a handicapped spot, not that you gave a weapon of war to a 12-year-old. And so now the federal government is prosecuting those folks. They've prosecuted over 500 individuals. They found one person that had trafficked 103,000 guns before getting caught. And so now there's accountability that's more upstream and not just cracking down on individuals, especially in communities that are most vulnerable in our country.
Well, I want to celebrate a recent win, I think, which was the Supreme Court upholding that it was not a violation of Second Amendment rights to say that somebody who's been deemed to be a threat, and specifically we're talking about intimate partner violence here, let's take away that gun. They cannot have a gun while they're subject to the restraining order. So we lead a domestic violence shelter within our organization, have for over 40 years. And I can tell you, this is such important work to make those kinds of very specific focus areas. So that I assume there was some celebrating in your office that day.
Yeah, well, I was here with y'all. So
okay, there's some celebrating here. Out here. We celebrate.
Yeah, a few drinks and cheers. Yeah, but no, it's a big win because we know that there is a very clear correlation between 100%. The domestic abuse and violence against women and fatal violence against partners. And you know, this upholding that was huge because we have so many new tools that we need to start using. You know, we just, like I said, we made gun trafficking a federal offense. We know that's how guns have
very
gotten
targeted.
Into the hands of domestic abusers. We also found that domestic abusers that are prohibited, their number one source of guns are unlicensed private sellers, so gun shows and online sales. And this administration closed those loopholes a few months ago. So now we know that the number one source for those abusers has been cut off. But if that was overturned, then it would have opened the floodgates, right, for guns to get into the hands of those who have shown harm. So it's a huge win.
Huge.
And I know a lot of lives will be saved. And I'm just so thankful that that standard is in place. And now we can keep building more resources to intercept the access to guns of those who we know are taking too many lives.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gregory Jackson, thank you so much for being with us today. Continue the success in the work that you're doing, all important work at the White House. Yeah. Thank you, our listeners, for joining in today. You can join us on CHC Radio or follow us on X or YouTube. And again, thank you for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare.
Of course. Thank you. Thanks
thank
for having
me. Thank
you
so much.
Thank you. Thanks.
This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.